Anyone who has ever witnessed a flock of birds making their way across a twilight sky is familiar with the beauty and the strangeness of life on Earth. But what about life beyond the Earth, where the stars and other planets are? Until recently, astrobiology, or the science of life in the universe, seemed to many scientists to be a game for dreamers. But according to astronomer and writer David Darling, many recent, apparently unrelated discoveries have led to a shift in mainstream scientific attitudes toward the subject.
One of the most important ones is that they found life on Earth living in all sorts of weird and hostile conditions that nobody ever previously thought possible, like in rocks deep underground, 2 miles underground, under incredible pressure, and at the bottom of the ocean near these hydrothermal vents where scalding water is pouring out of the Earth's crust. And that's opened up the range of places where it might exist elsewhere in the universe. Another big finding is that they've discovered that life started extremely early on Earth, just a few hundred million years after the Earth itself formed, which is incredible because the Earth was actually a very, very unfriendly place in those days. It was being bombarded by huge rocks from space. The crust was partially molten. And that suggests that life is easy to get going. And therefore, the likelihood that life exists out there has increased tremendously.
Mr. Darling adds that until recently, the existence of planets outside our solar system was also unproved.
And one of the great discoveries since 1995 is that there are indeed planets going around other stars that are similar to the Sun. In fact, I think the current total is 55 planets. They've also found a whole bunch of interstellar molecules floating among the stars, which are based on carbon. And of course, life here on Earth is based on carbon. One of the most intriguing findings, I think, was the discovery of an amino acid floating among the stars. An amino acid is a basic building block of life on Earth. You stick amino acids together and you get proteins, and proteins are one of the most important compounds in life on Earth. So all of these discoveries are adding to the excitement that life may be pretty common out there.
It is such a big universe. I asked David Darling why astrobiologists think that life beyond Earth would bear any resemblance to life on Earth. Why would a non-carbon-based life form be any stranger than a carbon-based one? In the cosmic sense, is there anything normal about an amino acid?
Astrobiologists are very, very aware of that. They're quite open to the fact that life could be based on any other element, for example, silicon or boron, which is another similar element, or even ammonia. Point is, we have to start looking for the kind of life we know, because the kind of life we know is what gives the signals that we can build instruments to search for. If life is based on silicon, for example, we have no idea what the biochemistry of silicon would look like, and so we cannot build instruments to look for it. We have to start looking for what we know.
If our familiar world, where giraffes and blowfish and spiders all live, can sometimes seem so odd, I wonder just how weird Mr. Darling and astrobiologists believe life might get in the great beyond.
You could get as weird as you can imagine and even beyond that, and we don't close our minds to any form of life. It gets back to a definition of what life is. At the moment, we only have sort of one version of it, so we define it in rather parochial, earthly terms. We know that intelligence forms a spectrum all the way from the simplest life forms up to ourselves.
But, Mr. Darling adds, we humans have found it difficult to come up with a good working definition even of our own intelligence.
We like to quantify things, so we have these ridiculous IQ tests, but they don't really measure much of what's involved in, say, artistic or musical intelligence. They don't measure things like ethical or moral aptitude or imagination.
Just as difficult in its own way has been determining and defining the intelligence of our apparently less sophisticated, non-human fellow Earthlings.
That would include the whales and dolphins. They've got big brains. They behave in what we judge to be an intelligent way. But we have trouble gauging their level of intelligence, just as we have trouble gauging the level of intelligence of our fellow humans. For example, we can't understand their language. In fact, we don't even know if a lot of the sounds they make involve a genuine exchange of information or whether they're part of echolocation or finding a mate. And another interesting point, of course, with the dolphins is that they don't have any technology because they don't have manipulative organs like hands. So that raises the question of how much intelligence in the universe at large is technological. And if it isn't, then we're going to find it impossible at this stage to prove that it exists or to communicate with it.
Still, imagining a thing can sometimes make finding that thing seem more likely. That is one reason why, according to Mr. Darling, many scientists like to read science fiction.
And in fact, many genuine scientists have written science fiction. You think of Carl Sagan, for example. He wrote the book Contact, which was turned into a very successful film. And in that book, he explored a lot of issues which he may have been reluctant to do in his normal professional career. It allowed him to expand his range of speculation. And the British astronomer Fred Hoyle did the same thing in his book The Black Cloud and a number of other science fiction stories too. And you'll also find that a lot of scientists are big, say, Star Trek fans. It helps them to, you know, ignite their imagination, and then they sort of filter down some of these wilder ideas into genuine science.
I asked David Darling how his own investigations into these realms have affected him personally.
You get some idea for the scale of things and the range of possibilities. You know, often when you get involved in your everyday life, the little parochial things start to seem very important, but even if you just gaze up at the night sky and realize what you're seeing and the distances over which you're seeing and the magnitude of it all, then life on Earth starts to seem both very small but also precious at the same time, because the Earth begins to look like this tiny little raft or almost speck of dust floating in space. So it does give you this sense of awe. And I don't really think you can do good science without that sense of awe behind it all.
Astronomer David Darling is the author, most recently, of Life Everywhere, The Maverick Science of Astrobiology. He spoke with me from his home in Brainerd, Minnesota. For Our World, I'm Adam Phillips reporting.